Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Hilary Masters. Hilary Masters was born and raised in Kansas City, Missouri, and he came to Pittsburgh in 1983 at the invitation of Carnegie Mellon University, where he is a member of the English department's creative writing program. Elegy for Sam Emerson is his ninth novel in a list of works that also includes two collections of short fiction, two books of personal essays, and a family memoir, Last Stands, Notes from Memory, that has been called a classic of the genre. The American Academy of Arts and Letters has given his work its award for literature. Hi, Hilary. Welcome to Prosody.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Glad to have you. How about we start off tonight with you reading from your book?
Okay, why don't we start right at the beginning? I like chapter one.
That sounds good.
A little more than halfway in his life's journey and scarcely out of the woods around Mansfield, Pennsylvania, Sam Emerson eased the rattling Ford station wagon into the intersection with Route 20, 220, going south towards Pittsburgh. Someday, he promised himself once again, he would get that loose muffler fixed. The faintly antiseptic odor of the mustard greens he had picked up before daylight at market rinsed the car's interior, not completely cleansing the mustiness generated by the worn upholstery and the debris collected on the floor beneath the seats. Yesterday afternoon, he and his chef, Sterling Wicks, both sipping from mugs of coffee, had gone over the week's menu as they stood in the restaurant's kitchen. The two men had been friends since their time at the hotel school at Penn State, when they had casually pushed awry the racial bars of that time by rooming together. "I thought the greens were a little sharp the last time you made them," Emerson told Wicks. "Maybe more feta would smooth them out. Mind you, I'm not being critical. Little grape tomatoes are a nice touch, colorful. It's your cornetone." His partner's long, elegant face seemed to pull down even more into something resembling a sneer, though the expression was only play-acting. "That's right. It is my contorny. Listen, boy, you just go get the groceries any time you want to do something. Hey, Rita," he gestured toward a line cook prepping a mound of mushrooms, "step to one side, please, so that numero uno can take his rightful place." The kitchen crew laughed and hooted, and Emerson retreated through the doors into the dining room, waving his arms to signal his surrender. A western sun splattered the windshield with a dazzle of flashes and flickers gaily inappropriate to the somber Chopin prelude that played from the car's speakers. Emerson had taken the tape with him to play on his return in a kind of farewell performance. Not many possessions left from his mother's life in a room at Crestview Meadows, photographs and old theater programs, some with her picture on the cover, a strand of amber beans, a few clothes hung in the closet, including her scarves and the down overcoat she had bundled about herself 8 years ago, as if in a last defense against the elements of time when she had walked into the nursing home on her own. Edith Olson had already given her papers and books to the Mansfield College Library, not so much a gift as a kind of dumping execution performed upon the good-natured, if not hapless, academics. Whatever had happened to the two steamer trunks, Sam Emerson could not remember, portable vaults that had been moved and set down in the different rooms of his childhood. Last night, when the nursing home had called him, Phoebe had been dressing, preparing to get home to her house in the Mexican War streets. Her neighborhood had been designated a historic area, several streets of brick row houses built right after the Civil War and named from battles of the previous conflict. It was Monday night. The restaurant on the floor below his penthouse closed on Mondays, and they had had the place to themselves. "They say she's not responding," he told her inquisitive glance. "Edie Olson not responding sounds serious." His effort was half-hearted. "I guess I better get up there tomorrow." "I'll go with you," Phoebe replied quickly. "I have no appointments tomorrow." She put some folders into her briefcase and snapped the clasps. Earlier, she had reviewed some of her clients' profiles while he made their supper. "That's swell of you to offer. Thanks, but this is a solo job." Phoebe had held his gaze for a moment, then shrugged and gathered her things together. "So we'll see you Wednesday. Nick is looking forward to the game. I think you may have wooed him from lacrosse." "Maybe before then," Emerson said. "I may pick up some basil at the old nursery on the way back. I could come over and put him in your planters when I get back." "I should be home near 6. We'll be happy to see you." Phoebe embraced him, and her heavy perfume, opium, rose around him. be careful on the road. Sam Emerson always wanted to delay these moments, the lovemaking that had preceded them, of course, but just as delicious were the intimacies that accompanied Phoebe putting herself back together after his joyous destruction of the professional woman's image she had carried off so well. The different snaps and fastenings, the slippings on and adjusting, the arrangements and critical appraisals made of those arrangements all composed a particular erotic litany, one that sounded profoundly in Emerson's sensibility. It was a ritual that somehow enriched the ceremony of flesh and rushing blood that had preceded it, made it even more endearing, but sometimes, like last night, her very efficient way of putting things back in order nudged him again, a reverent witness, with the thought that he might be only a convenient but no less appealing stop for this vital woman on her way home from work. The several years they had been together had caught Sam Emerson up in a sweet addiction, a fragrance of joyful routines that attended him through day and night, which he could almost inhale even as he slipped the Rubinstein Chopin into the car's tape deck this morning. The crystal notes of the prelude cheered him, and he decided the music celebrated his time with Phoebe, however it might end. He had brought his mother this particular version along with some other piano works, some arias of Puccini and several Beethoven sonatas, also pieces by Ravel. But whether she had ever played them herself for herself, he could only wonder. Sometimes, on a visit, he would carefully arrange them in the drawer of the stand by that bed, by her bed, and by the next time he went up to Mansfield, he would have forgotten the sequence and could not tell if they had been touched. But the music gave them something to share, pleasant sounds to fill the silence between them. "Let's have a little music," Emerson would suggest in the early days of his mother's residency at the nursing home. "Oh, yes, let's do. Have music," his mother would say, clapping her hands, her eyes becoming brilliant as if floodlights had suddenly come on at the end of her bed. She had given the line like something from an old drama, a comedy with French doors that open onto a terrace of sculpted shrubbery. "What shall it be? Chopin? Beethoven? Ravel?" "Not Ravel. He's too wishy-washy. Chopin. Always Chopin. Chopin it is," Emerson would say, and slip the tape cartridge into the player on the nightstand. The scene was played out with minor variations year after year, at mother and son with little to say to each other, conversation worn down and suspended in the recorded harmony. It had been a kind of intimacy, one of those attempts to make the best of an awkward destiny neither of them could explain. An affordable connection, Emerson often thought, but if he had expected the music playing on the car's tape deck now to stroke some sentimental chords within himself, the idea was shredded by the raucous shrapnel of illumination that burst from the woods on either side of the road. It was May, fresh and luminous, and the incorrigible sunlight revealed his folly and the truth. He could not be sad altogether. "Let it go, Edie," he had spoken softly into the ear of the shrunken figure in the bed on this last visit. She resembled an exhibit in the corner of an out-of-the-way museum. So it had all come down to this final interview, all the gaudy gaiety, the sturdy optimism, the whole adventure. Let it go. The rapid breathing did not hesitate. There was no sign she had heard him, and she was even aware of his presence. He couldn't wait any longer. He had to get back to the restaurant, and she could float in that odd suspension for hours, for days, maybe. The young leaves of birch and scrub maple seemed to mint the afternoon as he approached the Y-shaped junction, the country road made with the Route 220, the state highway. Earlier this morning, as he had neared the intersection from the south, Sam Emerson had considered, and not for the first time, how this meeting of byways disappearing into the grove of young trees resembled a Mons Veneris. On his many trips to Mansfield, he had amused himself by deftly bearing left to enter the turnoff into the county road, smoothly and without braking, all in one gliding advance. Not to halt or even slow down for oncoming traffic became a good omen for the day, for the time with his mother. "I feel like I'm slipping into a giantess," he told Phoebe on another evening, laughing at his own silliness and expecting her to gather up the dumb joke and weave it into one of her own high-spirited inspirations. But the imagery had irritated her, for she had put on her professional manner, an invisible smock, to regard him somewhat primly in the candlelight. So, Sam, are you more comfortable entering this intersection or leaving it? Which do you prefer? Oh, spare me the analysis, Dr. Konopsky. Save that for your clients downtown. He poured more polyak and directed her to the view, the bejeweled skyscrapers of Pittsburgh that rose across the Monongahela River. The skyline seemed to rise directly from beneath his penthouse. It was a splendid view, a splendor that diners in the restaurant below paid handsomely for. I understand what you're saying. I really get it. Coming up to this intersection at the end of what some have called the American century, the end of the millennium, and more than halfway in his own journey, does Sam Emerson get the whole picture? He had just left the village of Mansfield, another leg of round trip, 3 hours each way, that had been right 8 years in the making. For nearly 2 hours, he had sat by his mother's bed to monitor her shallow breathing, the rapid intake of breath like that of a girl on the edge of discovery. But the gaunt lines of the face and the pillow were both sad and frightening in their antiquity. How's she doing? The practical cheerfulness of a nurse had bustled into his reverie. The woman had swept in the room, officially straightened the bed sheets, and felt for his mother's pulse. She's doing. Your mom was an actress, wasn't she? Yes, Broadway and elsewhere, Emerson heard himself say. A lot of television roles. Juan Hart's Journey, the program's name did not distract the nurse's professional attention, and he felt a little chagrined by his spurt of press agentry. She also started the famous theater festival you have here every summer. I've heard of that, the nurse replied, carefully settling the withered arms and hand down on the coverlet. We never got to it. And Emerson had to admit he himself had trouble with the identity of the figure in the bed. She bore a little resemblance to the woman on the theater programs. He didn't recognize her. In her contest with the century, if not to heed, not to beat it, at least to meet it at the finish line, she had left him far behind, as she seemed about to do this morning. She was the original goodbye girl, which may have been her best role. Let it go, Edie. You've done well, he told the figure in the bed. How's that?
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Hilary Masters, reading from his novel, Elegy for Sam Emerson. There's a term that you use in the book, Hilary, promiscuous memory. And the idea that memory hops from one version of past to another. And I'm really interested in that. I mean, I think the book is that's what it grapples with.
Yeah.
That's what Sam grapples
that's
with.
Right. He's trying to find it. Yeah.
And I just wanted to talk about that a little bit. One, I think, you know, a lot of times in narrative, I think writers are thinking that they're looking for the one version or the one truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that what's interesting to me about this book and in your writing is that there's many versions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the way that memory kind of what it remembers at a given point, what it forgets, mm-hmm. what comes back. And so I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about like memory and Sam's kind of grappling with it and how you're working that out through your
yeah.
writing.
Well, I've been myself very interested in memory and its usages in the past and present and how the past informs the present. St. Augustine told us many years ago that all we know of the present is the past. And even as you and I sit here, Ellen, it's already over, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's...
There's no such thing. I think the present is really a rhetorical device that makes it convenient for us to separate things like the hours and the minutes, too.
Sure.
And so being promiscuous, I think it has no kind of... form of its own. And we give it a form, as historians give a moment a form, you know, and a reason. Looking back, we try to, and Sam is trying to look back in his own past. At this moment, his mother's death, a figure who was important to him more than he thought in his own history, and trying to figure out just what it was like, what that past was. And he can't really come to a final decision about it you think about it. And the past is also something we can make of it. I mean, we can make anything we want of the past by our own interpretations of it. We forget the details, you know, some embarrassing, some are just whatever, you know. And so that's what we think about. And So the book is kind of that, is a kind of a trip, a journey that he's making at this point in his life, when he has a lot of things to decide. Phoebe, his love at the moment, who is a very interesting woman, I think, a bit younger than he, but accomplished and already acquiring a reputation in her field of psychology and so forth. And so he has to make some decisions. And so his mother's death prompts him to find the answers to those decisions by going back and looking around.
And I was also interested in how that ties in with ritual in the book. Uh-huh. You know, there's this ritual he's going through of, you know, going to visit his mother. And
yeah.
And even how, like, we think things like ritual will be infused with
yeah.
with deep meaning. And it brings up different things at different times. And,
right.
You know, I'm remembering a moment where he's rather than... you know, the kind of sentimental version of ritual is, oh, you're going to see your dying mother because you want to spend those last few minutes with her. And in his head, he's thinking, well, I'm also going a certain number of times because I'm afraid the nurses will be counting
That's
how
right.
often I'm coming or not coming.
That's right. He's very much aware of how he looks and his appearance and things. Yes.
And even with his mother being an actress
yes.
and, you know, an actress ritual. Who had a certain amount of fame, but then ends up having other fame through being on, I'm assuming it's like a soap opera.
Yeah, soap opera. She became everybody's mother. Her one credit everybody keeps talking about it in the early days of television, when they had live television programs like Studio One and so forth, and actors we now accept like Paul Newman, who was just starting out, was appeared. Her run claim to fame is that one of these live shows she played Paul Newman's mother, and that keeps being brought up all the time.
Yeah, but this idea that ritual, and I think ritual and memory are, you know, go hand in hand.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we have rituals. It's
yes,
to
of course.
Invoke things.
Right. It gives memory a form.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it gives memory a form.
But what I love is the way that the narrative kind of, and Sam as a character, yeah. undercuts that, because the yeah. ritual sometimes
yeah.
doesn't have any more meaning than
no.
getting in the car.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And we give it a meaning. Right. Yeah. That's why it's promiscuous.
Right.
It's anybody's, actually.
Well, and I think it also gives some shape to, or opens a door to Sam as a character, because he seems, at least to me, like a man who is keeps using these rituals,
mm-hmm.
hoping they'll make some connection for him
mm-hmm.
that he just kind of awkwardly can't seem to make on his own.
Yeah. Well, he's been on his own pretty much.
Yeah.
His mother was an actress, of course. His father was a photographer of some note. And this is a period we should talk about this book. This book is a pre-9/11 book.
Mm-hmm.
I got kind of tired of post-9/11 books. So this is and that's why it's an elegy. It's talking about and describing a time pre-9/11, how we were before 9/11. And so he's going back to try and find out these things, and he's been left alone pretty much. His father was a photographer of some note who specialized in war pictures, starting in all the wars of the 20th century, and so he was left with his great aunt Ro in East Liverpool, Ohio. And I hope you've been to East Liverpool, Ohio. It's a great place, and there's a great place to eat there. I'll tell you about later. But anyway, so he was on his own, and of course he would join his parents from time to time in the summer, different places, things like that. And so he had to he was always questioning, finding out, you know, what's next and who and where are we going? And he avoids the question, who am I? I think somewhat. But anyway, he's trying to find his place,
right?
And that place here in the book is pretty much in the past,
right? And I would say not only who am I, but how did I get where I'm at?
Yes, that's right.
You know, that seems the very present question with him all the time.
Yeah, right, exactly.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Hilary Masters, reading from his novel, Elegy for Sam Emerson. Hilary, will you read a little bit more?
Sure. I picked one of those past times that he goes into.
Great.
And this is when his mother is appearing in the stock company in Bucks County, and she's taken over a role that Tallulah Bankhead usually plays. But Tallulah couldn't make it, and so she's playing the part. And it's called A Summer in Bucks County, and it includes his father, who's back from the Spanish Civil War, late 30s. In memory, that summer stretches on and on like a swing at the top of an arc, hanging in the light, never to come down. Sam never wants it to end, though he misses Aunt Roe and his friends in East Liverpool. All three of them are together, his mother, father, and he, live in a little cottage by an old canal. He's never seen his father, so relax. He wears old pants and short sleeve shirts, unbuttoned, so the boy sees for the first time the thick hair on his father's narrow chest. Hairy Ape, his mother calls him sometimes, or Tarzan, when he had loafs about in baggy swim trunks. Though that doesn't make sense, because Johnny Weissmuller, who swings around in a jungle at the Vista Theater, has no hair at all on his chest. His chest is as smooth as Sam's. It's like school being out all time, save for his mother's schedule at the summer theater, the Bucks County Playhouse. But his father hasn't carried back a camera since a couple of weeks one summer in East Liverpool when they were together for a little bit. In the meantime, he's been away to Greece and has just returned from France, which has just surrendered. He's brought Sam a beret. The photographer ambles about the stone cottage. It came with his mother's job at the theater, coming to rest on the steep staircase by the fireplace that goes to the second floor. Or he lounges on a bench just outside the door against the whitewashed wall of the building, taking the sun. Sam thinks he looks like one of those old people in East Liverpool who had just missed the bus to Steubenville and are waiting for the next one. His father looks older, though he has only been a year. When he must put on some clothes for a party at the Playhouse, or when someone invites him to a dinner, Owen Emerson pulls on a pair of worn twill slacks and a rayon shirt the color of ripe cherries. Thick-soled sandals made of rope are strapped to his feet. His toes are crooked, and the nail of one large toe is black. It takes a whole summer to come off. If you don't care how you look to my friends, you might set a good example for the boy, Sam hears his mother say. That shirt is a hopelessly vulgar. I certainly don't want to offend your playmates, his father says. Sam is outside practicing yo-yo tricks. He can't do walking the dog on the uneven ground, but he has gotten pretty good with rocking the cradle. My playmates, as you call them, are among the leading intellectuals of this country. They have causes and believe in them strongly, Sam hears his mother say. Sure. I recognize such belief is an anathema to someone like you who has no cause. Yeah, that's right. Their voices are not angry. In fact, they sound to Sam as if they are making jokes, having fun. All those causes look alike to me, Dimples. I've made too many pictures of them. Oh, let's hear it from the wounded hero, the sensitive soul in an unfeeling universe. You've been boozing too much with Hemingway. You sound like one of his trashy novels. Show us your wound, Roberto. As you wish, Miss Olson. It sounds like his father gets up from the floor. His chair is scraped on the floor. Then Sam hears his mother laugh low in her throat, and then silence. You villain, she says after a little. Softly, the yo-yo spins within the string lattice Sam has made of his fingers. I have a matinee today, remember? She seems to be talking against something. Sam releases the yo-yo, and it falls and then snaps back into his hand perfectly. He wants to hear more, but he's nervous about listening, so he moves toward the old privy as he hears their steps rapidly taking the stairs to the second floor. But most days, father and son have to themselves. His mother is always busy at the theater, rehearsing or meeting with different people. It's an exciting time for her. She looks like she's about to jump into a wonderful lake, and contrary to his father's appearance, she has become younger looking. All of her has been refreshed, and the light tan she's acquired gives her a sultry look. She spends a lot of time with the writers and theater people whose summer in and around New Hope. His father calls them parlor pinks, which is a funny name that makes Sam think of wallpaper, but he knows that it has nothing to do with wallpaper. Occasionally, just to please her, his father accompanies her to some of those get-togethers, which reminds Sam that his father is a little famous too, and that people want to meet him almost more than his mother. Me and Sam are going around to look for some hats in Hatboro, he might say. They survey dry creek beds, poolside ditches, old barns, and the weathered tumbles of deserted homesteads on back roads. Sam captures salamanders for a terrarium he started in a large round tin that held chocolates, a gift to his mother. They spend drowsy afternoons by the canal, fishing poles extended over the still, mucky water, They eat chunks of bread and cheese, provisions, his father calls them, beside a pond they discovered at the end of what seems to be an all-day hike through scrub pines and juniper bushes and over carpets of moss laid over levels of slate. High pussy willows curtain the pond, patrolled by dragonflies, sporadically pelted by the commentary of frogs. Sam wakes from a nap lying against his father, his face deep in the man's sweaty body, pressed against a damp undershirt that smells of burnt wood. The fireplace in the cottage has the same smell and is an odor both obnoxious and addictive all at once. Sam is embarrassed to have fallen asleep in the middle of his father's story about bears, but Owen Emerson is smiling down upon him. This bony face had softened, and the falcon eyes looked hooded in the afternoon haze. A good dream, boyo? You missed some excitement. What happened? What's happening is that the frogs have revolted. They have united, held a convention, and formed their own party. They say they are no longer going to beat their butts on the ground. History demands that they be given wings. You missed all that. Will they? Asks Sam, still half asleep. He isn't always sure when his father is joking. Get their wings? Come the revolution, boyo. All God's children will get wings. But the revolution may have come and gone. He starts singing something like a hymn in the middle by the frog pond. His voice is light. The order of everything is turned upside down. Topsy-turvy. Aunt Roe would not approve. They eat pork chops for breakfast and Wheaties for supper, or at any hour of the day and night. Chuck's clocks have seemed to not to matter, except for his mother's time at the theater. And Sam wears the same pair of shorts and the same shirt, and his mother never says anything. They eat thick slabs of the local tomatoes on white bread with mayonnaise and onion. The tomato's juice burns the skin of his chin. Surprisingly, his father knows how to make clabbered biscuits with buttermilk. That his father can cook is an amazing discovery. Owen Emerson stands easily at the small coal oil stove in the kitchen. As the kerosene burns, the stove makes a glub glub sound like the frogs creaking, croaking, and the sun accompanies the smell of the pancakes to wake him in the mornings. He sees his father flipping the pancakes over and dropping in a handful of the raspberries that grow wild along a fence line. The pancakes are lathered in butter and Cairo syrup, spiked with local honey, bought at a road stand. They live like gypsies, his mother's schedule at the theater the only rule to be observed. "Holy mother of God," she says, and starts up from their late breakfast. "I got a tech in 15 minutes. What are you bums doing today?" "The president has commissioned us to collect specimens of dinosaur droppings," Owen Emerson says. Sam is caught off guard by his father's answer and chokes on some pancakes, going the wrong way, down his throat and up through his nose. He can't believe his father had said such a thing. Droppings! He's pretty sure he knows what that means. "Well, please, no more. No more weed specimens. The last bunch made me swell up like a pigeon. I could hardly get through my lines." "Never fear, my little pigeon," his father croons his W.C. Fields imitation. "Rest assured, yes, indeedy, rest assured." The two of them kiss and embrace, and Sam briskly swabs the syrup on the plate with the last piece of flapjack.
Believe it or not, we're done. That was lovely.
Oh, good.
The work of Hillary Masters. Thanks so much for coming, Hillary.
Thank you so much, Ellen. It was fun.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.